long time ago. Last time was a long time ago, way back then. The last lecture, we were talking about structure and materials and understanding the way forces move through buildings and then how materials resist those forces due to the character of their molecular bonds, and how we make a match between the forces that are moving through the building and the materials that we're using to resist those forces, and the quantity of material matching the quantity of force, and that really shaping what the structure of the building looks like. And we looked at bearing structures, those that are compressive loads primarily, and the kinds of shapes and forms, the kinds of materials, the kind of character that comes out of that. And in that case, largely masonry kinds of buildings, brick, stone, concrete, and arches and vaults and domes, and how all of those things really come out of not an aesthetic predilection, but they are extraordinarily high-performing structural shapes and forms. They are carrying those loads in an efficient way and applying the materials in an efficient way to create an elegant, lean structure. Then we also looked at bending structures, where it's more a frame generally, and sometimes it's a cantilever, but they're made out of wood and they're made out of steel, and they're completely different in terms of their visual character and the possibilities architecturally, and they really inspire a completely different kind of architecture. So the Twitter card question at the end of that session, I ask you, does this, if we're honest about this, if we're authentic about this, if we really make the architecture emanate from those structural principles and roots, does that make a more beautiful building? Does that make a more aesthetically pleasing architectural experience? And we looked at a couple of buildings along the line that were, really, really drawn from that. And then, you can imagine plenty of others that are just, it's just scenographic. It's just like a stage set. There really isn't any basis in structure. So these are the kinds of responses we got there. I ask you to say on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you place this as importance? So someone says, "I think the material and technology used in a building is a 10 towards the contribution of its beauty. It allows you to appreciate the building more, knowing what it is made of and the process it took to build it." Someone else says 10. "The structural components and technological achievements makes a building more beautiful. Even for the everyday person that doesn't understand the technology, there's an innate, intangible love and beauty that emanates from that building." Someone else says 10. "A building's technology mirrors the time frame in which it was built, and we can see how technology has developed, what kinds of materials changed, and ultimately what was considered beautiful at its time. Once it is built and lasts into a different era or time period, this beauty becomes timeless and allows us to see a glimpse into the past." Someone else says 9. "There is a dissonance in a building if its technology does not match its aesthetic. Integrating these two facilitates understanding of the building." Someone else says 7. "It's not something that I think ultimately determines the beauty of a building, but when used properly, there really is an underlying impression of excelling at your craft and truly knowing your work that makes it more impressive." Someone else says, "On a scale of 1 to 10, I give this structural technology a 7 in terms of its contribution to aesthetic beauty. Some technologies, like reinforced concrete, can be very beautiful when combined with other elements of form, as in some of Le Corbusier's designs. However, some technologies are boring and unappealing from an aesthetic standpoint. For instance, most ductwork and plumbing is not pleasing to the eye. And finally, someone says, I don't think it's necessarily important to include the technology in the aesthetic of a building. But I do think including an expression of technology adds a certain something extra to the way we experience a building. The hints to the technology add some sort of intellectual beauty. I think it warrants a balance of the two, so I would rank it in importance as a 5. So, interesting range of reactions there. So, today is the next to the last lecture in this series on physical considerations in architecture. You get a signal of that by the fact that you had an extra handout today for essay or for short answer questions for quiz number 2. Quiz number 2 is a week from today, next Tuesday. And we'll have this lecture today, a lecture on Thursday. Then the test will cover this whole segment where we've been dealing with all kinds of physical considerations. The physical considerations we're talking about today have to do with construction. Now, that's a little different than structure and materials. Structure and materials are about when the building's finished, does it stand up? Does it hang together? Is it an efficient, elegant expression of the forces of gravity and wind and all of those loads that are on a building? But today we're talking more about the construction process, how you make a building. How does the actual making process affect the design of a building? And can it be a large contributor to the character of a building? And we'll be making the argument today that especially in moments when there was innovation in construction methods, sometimes that was absolutely seminal in allowing certain possibilities architecturally. And we're really going to be looking at what are the possibilities of innovation in construction process that then allow for new and innovative ways of doing architecture. So we're going to begin today, though, kind of like we have in the last few lectures, of just talking at a very elemental level. What is the construction process? What is a normal construction process? And actually, I don't know, I'm an architecture nerd, what can I say? But I love watching a building under construction. It's just fascinating. And honestly, this is right at this moment, it's a good time to look at construction on this campus because we have 3 huge projects, really game changer projects for this campus that are under construction right now. So there is the whole new medical school over here near the corner of Red River and 15th Street, all along Trinity, 4 new buildings UT is building in that area that will be the new Dell Medical School. Those buildings are latter stages of construction. The first of them will open on May 31st. 2 others will open at the end of the summer, and then another one will open in 2017. So they're underway. You can watch them being built, and it's totally transforming that whole area that people didn't even think of as campus. But honestly, now it's going to be a real campus over there. Also, on the corner of MLK and Guadalupe, there's an enormous hole in the ground. Oh, my God. They have been building that hole for a year. I mean, I don't know if you guys have been watching, but whoa, dude, what a hole. Now they're starting to fill it up, but it has been one mammoth hole in the ground for a long time. And that's going to be the new Graduate School of Business, Macomb School of Business. The graduate school will be there. And that one will be another kind of game-changer building. It actually will connect with the AT&T Center underneath Wida Street there. And there will be a whole new extension of that sort of meeting and convention facility that's in AT&T that will go into the new Macomb's building. And then the Graduate School of Business will be above ground there, plus tons of parking, and so that's why the big hole. Then the third big project is the EERC building, brand new engineering building over on the engineering campus, which is mammoth an enormous new research facility, actually two towers that are connected by an atrium on the lower levels. For those of you who are engineering students, it will finally give you a real nexus for the College of Engineering, a place where people can hang out. There'll be a cafe, there'll be study areas, there'll be student-oriented spaces, things engineering's never had that will be in the new EERC, plus tons of new research capability in that building. But what I'm talking about today is, man, you should just go by and look at these things and watch over a period of time and see these buildings come alive. I don't know. To me, this is it's a fascinating process. And when you think about it, like to build the Dell Medical School, this was there was at one point on the site, there were over 3,000 people working on that site. It's a huge effort. And this is over several years. And just the coordination of getting all those materials in that location, pre-manufactured somewhere else, installed there, just the whole enterprise is a mammoth, mammoth undertaking. So today we're going to be talking about that construction process and how that affects architecture. So I'm going to say at the beginning here that there are seven steps in a normal construction process. And they don't always go in exactly this sequence. And in fact, that's been a change even in the last 10, 15 years, is that those sequences have moved somewhat. But in general, there are seven steps in the process. The first is site work, that you would go into any location, and it may mean in an urban instance, it may mean demolishing smaller buildings that are there. For the new McCombs, they had to tear down a burger place that had been there for, I don't know, ages. People wept over the demise of that dumpy little burger place. But anyway, there was a burger place there. There was a gas station on the corner. It had all kinds of mitigation of, you know, there had been tanks storing gasoline. They seep and, yeah. Repeat? Okay, the first step is site work. Site work. S-I-T-E-W-R-K. You're just preparing the site to start the project. So the first step is site work. The second step is foundations. And that's where you're beginning now to integrate the building with the structure of the ground. All that we talked about last time about structure, all those loads have to go somewhere eventually. And they go into the freaking ground. So all of those loads get transferred into the earth. And sometimes it's good soil conditions and they receive that well. And sometimes it's crappy soil conditions and it doesn't receive it well. So, you know, in a lot of places in Austin, we have to go through a lot of bad soil to get to the bedrock down below. So that means drilling piers through crappy soil, and eventually having something to rest on the limestone bedrock down below. Sometimes the rock is just right under the surface. So the foundation is very much dependent on the conditions of the soil that are there. But so you may mean, it may mean you're having to drill these piers. That's what they did for McCombs. You could see them, first they dug the big hole, and then they had a bunch of machines in there and they were drilling piers even farther down to hit the bedrock. And that's currently, there's a building under construction right behind Whole Foods. They've also dug a huge hole there. Right now they're drilling those piers to get down to bedrock in that area right there. So the second step is creating the foundation. For a single family house, it may be not much more than just kind of leveling the ground and pouring a slab that rests right on the dirt that's there. For very small buildings, very light loads, the foundation may be simple. Digging a few little grade beams, laying the slab in grade foundation on top of that. Or for a high-rise building, it may be mammoth, mammoth piers. There are a few buildings, various places in the world, where they're going down 100 feet for piers. Whoa! That's like drilling for oil, almost. But you're going down to where you get the right conditions to set the foundation. So the first step is site work. The second step is foundations. The third step is then to create the structural system. And that means, in the case of, let's say, McCombs or EERC, now they're doing a reinforced concrete frame in both of those buildings. And you can see those coming out of the hole on MLK, or you can see them now rising. They're probably about the fourth or fifth floor over at EERC, and they're building up those reinforced concrete columns and beams, and that's creating the structural frame for the building. The fourth step is then enclosure and skin, creating a thermal and moisture protection for the building. And sometimes if it's a load-bearing wall, that wall may be doing 90% of the work, and maybe you're just putting some insulation on one side of the wall. In other instances, like a frame, you're having to create a whole sandwich of things that have insulation and vapor barrier and water proofing and all of those things that are some kind of infill between the frame that is creating the enclosure of the building. The fifth step is then inside the building creating partitions, making functional spaces within it. We've got laboratories, we've got offices, we've got classrooms, we've got corridors. I mean, all of those subdivisions, you create all the partitions in a building. The sixth step is then integrating the systems. And these days, this is huge. This takes months and months to run all the wiring in the building, run all the plumbing in the building, put all the hotspots for the Wi-Fi network in the building, run all the electrical wiring through the building, put all the networking panels in there, all the transformers, all of the mechanical systems, so heating and cooling systems, ductwork, boilers, chillers, all of those accoutrements in a building, because unlike the Pantheon, where they didn't freaking have to worry about any of that stuff, in our buildings, we have tons and tons of systems that we have to use because we demand lights to turn on and heating and air conditioning to work and Wi-Fi spots to work and all of those things that have to be built into the building. And then the seventh and final step is the finishes in a building. And then maybe you're going back and you're putting really nice wood paneling inside a room like this, or you're putting carpet on the floor, or you're pouring terrazzo, or various materials that would be the finished materials of a building. Now, right now at Dell Medical School on the Education Administration building, the one that will be finished May 31st, they're absolutely at that finish stage. They're pouring the terrazzo, they're buffing the terrazzo, they're painting the walls, they're putting the finishes on a building they've been working on for almost 2 years. So this is a normal construction process. And these days, maybe you put in the systems a little earlier than you put in the partitions. Maybe you alter those slightly, but all of those steps have to be a part of the construction process. And all of them are different trades and different subcontractors and different skill sets of people that come to the job and do that. The electrician is doing a very specific kind of work that he or she knows how to do extremely well. A mason or someone who creates the concrete formwork, completely different set of skills and capability and even body type. You can walk on a construction site and I can show you the difference between, I can identify usually that guy's an electrician or that guy is a laborer or that guy is a steel worker. Because there's such different capabilities. It requires sometimes really strong big guys and sometimes little wimpy, wiry guys. Oddly enough, I'm saying guys here because this is an interesting thing to me, but maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there was a huge influx of women onto construction sites. And you began to see women working on construction sites. And part of this was the women's movement. Those were good paying jobs and they wanted access to them. Part of it also was a greater mechanization of jobs on the construction site. Maybe you didn't need so much brawn to do a lot of the work that had been done on construction sites. And, you know, it was really remarkable 25 years ago or so. Maybe 5-10% of the workers on a construction site would be women. Nowadays, for some reason, that just went away. It is very, very rare to see women outside of, say, people working for the contractor or in a supervision or a managerial position. There are women on the job site in those roles and as architects, but laborers, pretty rare. And that's an interesting sociological thing. Okay, so that's the normal way you build a building. Now, it often is the case that we need to alter that normal process in order sometimes for economy. Often that's the generator. How can we do this more efficiently? And in the United States, because you can't export construction jobs, you know, you can't send those construction jobs to China very easily or even Mexico. They have to be done freaking right here in the United States. And our labor is relatively expensive in the United States. So we're constantly trying to find labor-saving ways of building. Is there a way to do it with less labor cost? So, for example, 30, 40 years ago, if you were building a wood frame house in a regular suburban neighborhood, the way that would work is you'd order the lumber yard to send out a bunch of 2x4s, a bunch of 2x6s, a bunch of 2x8s, 2x12s, you know, and they'd come in standard lengths and they'd all get delivered to the site. And then there would be carpenters who would look at the drawings, and they would see the dimensions, and they would measure those pieces, and they would cut them, and they would assemble all of that frame of the building right there on the site, cutting all those pieces and fitting them together using a hammer and nails to whack, 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 put those things together. That was how you built a house. Nowadays, it's really quite different. Number one, let's say a truss, a gabled truss that goes over your house and it makes the roof shape. Nowadays, instead of them doing that on the site, that would be done in a factory somewhere. And you'd have gang-nailed wooden trusses, and those would be manufactured in a much more efficient way and in a climate-controlled environment. So if it's raining, you can still build it, because on the job site, when you're framing a house, you're not working in the rain. Can't do it. But in a factory, you can produce those trusses. And so they pre-manufacture all those trusses. They don't use hammer and nails. They lay them out on the concrete slab, and they have nailer plates, and they have machines that just go wonk, 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 wonk every joint, and it nails that whole joint together with about 10 connections on each piece of wood. And much faster, much stronger, actually, something that would be hard to do on the site but can be done in a factory environment. Then all those are delivered onto the site, and you have, 30 gang-nailed wooden trusses. They get a little cherry picker out, and they lift those up, and they put them bam, 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 bam. And suddenly in 2 days, the entire framing of the roof is there. What would have taken 3 weeks for a bunch of guys to do, cutting, sawing, nailing, hauling all those pieces up individually. This is a change in the construction process that is due to the fact that we're trying to save labor in the United States. Nowadays, there's also all kinds of things. Instead of, building the studs and then putting the sheathing on the outside of the studs and then waterproofing that and then putting the insulation in between the studs, nowadays we have what are called SIPS panels. And they're just a pre-manufactured panel that has the insulation and the vapor barrier and waterproofing and all of that in an assembly, and you just put it up and kind of tape it together, and it makes a wall system. So these are labor-saving devices. Sometimes, however, the innovation in construction process may be generated by something else, like schedule. A lot of times, schedule is a very, cost issue. A lot of times people have huge construction loans, and if they do it quickly, then they don't have to pay as much interest on their loans. If it takes a long time, then they're paying more interest on their loans, and they're not able to use the building in that period of time. So schedule becomes a pretty big driver of construction process too. I want to show you an example of an interesting schedule problem that created a big innovation in construction process. This was actually 50 years ago. They're now already talking about the 50th anniversary of Hemisphere in San Antonio. This was a half a world's fair, a Hemisphere, that was done in 1968 in San Antonio. So at Hemisphere, they had identified all the countries that were going to have exhibits there, and they'd gotten them organized, and the whole Hemisphere site was prepared, and they were building the buildings to accommodate the Hemisphere. Everything was going great. Then they realized, oh my God, we're going to have more people come than we anticipated. This is going to be more popular than we thought. And we don't have enough hotel rooms in San Antonio to accommodate the crowd. It was all going to be in the summer of 1968, and this huge horde of people from especially all over Latin America were going to come and be visitors to San Antonio. And they didn't really have enough hotel rooms. But they didn't have this realization until about 14 months before Hemisphere was supposed to open. And 14 months is not enough time to plan a building, design a building, build a building, and have it open. It's just not enough time in a normal construction process. So they said, well, can we shorten the construction process? Is there a way that we could build a whole high-rise hotel in 10 months? 10 months, that's really, really fast. So what they did was they completely changed the construction process. So they went out to a site outside of San Antonio, and they started building hotel rooms. And they built these reinforced concrete boxes, that each one of which would be a hotel room. So they have repetitive formwork, and they just set up that formwork. They pour those walls and floors and ceiling, and they make that little hotel room. And they're doing them just bang, 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 right down the line there. They're manufacturing hotel rooms. These boxes that are exactly the dimension of the hotel room. That's the door from the corridor to the hotel room. That's half the corridor sticking out on one side, half the corridor sticking out on the other side. And the idea is you pre-manufacture these things and you just glue them together on each floor. So those reinforcing bars that are sticking out there get meshed with the reinforcing bars there. You pour some concrete to grout those two together, and that makes a floor of hotel rooms. And they did them very completely. They put the glass in. There's the patio door. There's the rail on the patio right there. They even went so far as to, they put the plumbing in. They put pictures on the wall. They like affixed the pictures to the wall. They did pretty much everything. Made this hotel room, and they put it on a truck and took it to the construction site. Meanwhile, while they were building all those hotel rooms, they were also building an elevator core on the site and a platform to stack all those hotel rooms on. But the cool thing here is they're able to do that all at the same time. They're doing the systems and materials and finishes at exactly the same time as they're doing the foundation and the structural framework on the site here. So that all gets prepared as the pre-manufactured hotel rooms are being prepared. And then they just bring them to the site, and they have a big crane, and they start stacking them up. You know, each floor stacked up like that, that's one half of the hotel floor with its little cantilever piece out for the hallway. Then here's the other half on this side. And they're stacking those completed hotel rooms up and making the hotel. And in 10 months, they were able to do this by this very, very efficient, very time-saving construction process. And many of you probably know the Palazzo del Rio Hotel, right on the Riverwalk in San Antonio, right by the Hemisphere site. It's a Hilton hotel now, been there for 50 years. And it actually reflects, you can see all those stacked boxes. You can see the stacked boxes. the architectural character of it reflects a construction process that was very innovative and unusual. The interesting thing is, at this point, there were many people who were thinking, this is the future. We're going to pre-manufacture buildings, and we're going to deliver them to the site, and that's how we're going to, especially housing, hotels, things like that, that's how they'll be built. For some reason, not so. There were a few hotels built in this process, especially like in Caribbean areas, where it's really hard to build there, so they build the boxes on shore, and they'd ship them out and then stack up this hotel on some island in the Caribbean. But in terms of normal hotels, all the hotels have been built in Austin recently. Not a single one uses this process. They're all built much more conventionally. I don't know. Maybe what is the conservatism that's there in the construction industry? Okay, so for class today, we're going to really look kind of intensively at these three construction processes. And let us see how over time, over all of history, construction process has always been a huge part of making architecture. Just cannot understand architecture without understanding it as a process of making, of constructing the building. So we've looked a couple of times before a little bit at Gothic cathedrals. We're going to concentrate today on one particular cathedral at Amiens in France. This was done between 1220, and actually that other number is wrong. It was done between 1220 and 1288, and it took 68 years to build this building. And this is a high Gothic cathedral. That means that Gothic cathedrals were well defined by this point. They had done a number of them, and they did them in a similar construction process. So at this point, they kind of got it down. They know how to build this really amazing, huge building in tiny little villages all over France and Germany, which is really where Gothic cathedrals sprang initially. England a little bit, too. But these were the real centers for Gothic building. But it was like sending a man to the moon. I mean, these were huge undertakings that these people did, and it took 68 years to do this, a really, really long commitment of those people. There are enormous innovations in terms of structure and materials in these buildings. They're made out of stone. They're compressive structures. But they wanted them to be very tall and light. They were supposed to connect you to God in the heavens, and so they wanted you to see these vertical spaces, and they wanted tons of light to pour in. And that's very different from most bearing structures that have heavy walls all the way around. So one of the real innovations that allowed them to do this was the invention of the flying buttress, which are these compressive arched forms that come away from the wall, as you see here. They hold up that tall wall with these arched forms over here and carry those loads down through these buttresses into the ground. That means that this wall doesn't have to be so solid and thick. That wall can, in fact, have large openings in it, and that can let light into the space inside. So what you're trying to do is reduce the mass in that wall by carrying those loads out to buttresses out here, allowing that wall to have huge windows like this that then could be clear glass or stained glass and would let all this light into the cathedral. So they're innovating in terms of structure and materials. But the real thing we're talking about today is, whoa, dude, how do you get all of that incredible quantity of stone up there? How do you get all those arches made? Well, yeah, the arches are great when they're completed, but half of an arch falls down. We saw that in the Colosseum last time. You know, half of an arch is worthless structurally. Well, how do you build it, get there all at once? You can't get there all at once. It has to be piecemeal. How do we build these things that we know will be stable when they're completed, but how do we go through the process of making that? And they've got these aspirations, and especially by the High Gothic period, incredibly tall and light and airy, and it doesn't feel like a compressive structure. How do we get this assembly all up there in place and make it happen in an era with no mechanical tools, no cranes, no cherry pickers, no very, very rudimentary tool capability. So let's walk through how you make a Gothic cathedral and where they had to invent building processes in order to really make this happen. So we start with the foundation, just like we talked about a minute ago. This building is made out of limestone. There actually were two different kinds of limestone they used. At the lower part of the wall here, where the building meets the ground, and for the foundations and for the crypt, which is actually, they built a hole here too and built a crypt underground. All of that is made of this dark gray limestone, which is super dense. It doesn't absorb any water. It's not porous, because when you're below the ground has moisture in it. And if the moisture is absorbed into the stone, it deteriorates the stone. So you need to use extremely dense stone. They take that up to a certain point here where all the moisture is. And then they transition to this lighter sort of tan stone, much warmer colors, really more beautiful stone in many ways, which was much easier to work. It was more porous. It was not as hard to cut. So they used that for the bulk of the building up above. So already that process of building, how you put the stone in the ground versus how you put it above the ground, was affecting the look and character of the building. Now, one thing that was, you know, you can just build up and up and up, and you put some scaffolding around, and you cut all the stone from the quarry, and you bring it out to the site, and you stack it up, 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 and more scaffolds, taller scaffolds. But only eventually they get to the point where their scaffolds don't work anymore. They did not have big timbers in the area of France that they were working with here. If you wanted big timbers, you had to import them from a long way away, and it was very expensive to do that. You're not going to do that just for a scaffold. The little bitty pieces of wood they could use in a scaffold, you go up about 50, 60 feet, that's as far as it goes. It starts falling down after that. So wait, we want this building to be 120 feet tall, but we only can take the scaffolding up to 50 feet. How do we put our masonry in place above that? That's a building process problem. And they invented this system where they would embed scaffolding into the wall they just built. So they would make little holes in the wall. You can see some here. And they would leave those for inserting scaffolding into the wall. And as you built up the wall, you would build up your scaffolding capability higher and higher and higher. You could go all the way to heaven building like this. So that was a solution to the scaffolding problem. Then how do you get your stone up there onto that scaffold? And then they built these little windy stairs like that. Those were for carrying the materials up to the top. And they were not, it was not easy, but you get a couple of stones. You walk up that little windy stair the whole way, and you finally get there, and you deposit it on that little bit of cantilevered scaffold off the wall. The mason puts it in place. You do that over and over and over. And again, it allows you to carry the materials up, to have the work surface there, and to continue the height of the wall above what a scaffold connected to the ground could do. These days, those little windy stairs, so has anybody gone to the top of a Gothic cathedral in Europe? Anybody? Okay. About 20 or 30 people. So I would lay you odds that the way you got to the top was one of those little windy stairs, right? And it seems to us today, well, they put those in for tourists, for American tourists, to go up and get a good view of the city. Bullshit, of course not. Those were for construction. And for centuries, they were just a remnant. They were left and there was nothing to do with it. Why would you go to the top of the building except to carry materials to the top of the building? There was no reason. And then when tourism came in later, those began to be the only way that you could get people up to these viewing platforms at the top of the building. So they suddenly became useful all over again. So what happens when you get a big rose window like that? You can't extend that scaffolding cantilevered out from the glass. It's not strong enough. So what you have to do is you have to build other kinds of structures that work around those irregularities in the wall and allow you to still go up and erect the building around and up higher than that rose window would be. Okay, so we're able to build up and up and up above where the scaffolding could go, and now we keep going up and up. But now we begin to think, okay, well, we got to span across that nave, that big central space, and we're not going to, honestly, they did not know how to make a vault that would go that far. You could conceivably do something like the domes of Hagia Sophia or the dome of the Pantheon, but they didn't know how to do that. They didn't have that technology. So instead, they were using a bending system to span across the nave. And that's where they did import big timbers from. Some of them would come all the way from Lebanon across the Mediterranean into France. And, you know, they came from different places, some of them from the forest of Germany. But these big pieces of timber. And what they would do at the end is they would build this big wooden truss, not so different from some of the trusses we looked at from Japanese architecture last time. And that would be that spanning element over the nave there. But again, how the hell do you get that truss up there? You don't know. They didn't either. So, you can imagine building the truss. You can imagine it sitting up there. But they had no mechanism for getting it up there. So what they would do is they would construct the truss on the ground and make it disassemblable. So you would, each of those joints would be a notched joint with a pin that connected it. And they would do all the carpentry for that, all the routing out and all the making of the connections down here on the ground. But they would be able to be then disconnected. Then they would take all of those pieces up individually and reassemble the truss up high above the nave. But even then, those big pieces of timber were extremely heavy. A person couldn't just carry that, and you certainly couldn't take it in that little circular stair going up. So they began to then use hoists, and they used pulleys to hoist those pieces up. But they didn't have any machinery for the hoist. You couldn't put a little electric motor on it and power the hoist. So instead, they made these wheels, like you see right there, and those had human gerbils inside them. So a guy would go in there, and he would climb like that in the wheel, and that would turn the wheel, and that would power the hoist that would raise the individual piece of wood up to the top of the building. And then they would very carefully assemble it and reconnect it and make the truss up there. You can imagine the danger and the difficulty and the cleverness of that solution for how to construct those trusses at the top of the building. So now we got the trusses in place up here. We're trying to make these flying buttresses, very essential for that wall right there. And of course, we're making arches. But again, I mentioned before, the arch is a really great shape structurally when it's complete. But three quarters complete, it's worthless. It won't hold anything. It won't even stand up by itself. So how do you make that? Well, that solution was similar to what they were doing with the trusses. They built what they called centering, which were these big formwork pieces. And they'd insert them up there, and then they would come back in, and they would put the stone on top of them. And when all the stone was in and all of it was set up, then you had a structural arch, and you could pull the piece of wood out, the centering out, and then you could reuse that same piece of centering for the next flying buttress and the next flying buttress and the next flying buttress. And so they could have some economy in construction of that way. And there were dozens and dozens of these. So that would have been a long construction process to make that flying buttress. And that's very much the same way they made the pointed arches. They would have made wooden centering, and then they would build that arch around it, and then they would use that same centering for the next arch and the next arch and the next arch. Now, that's beginning to make a reason why the arches are the same size, the flying buttresses are the same dimensions. That rhythm, that repetition, had in part to do with the fact that they needed an efficient construction process. They couldn't have each one being different. It had to repeat itself in order to even be kind of barely feasible as a way of building the building. Wow, how about those groin vaults at the top of the side aisles? Oh man, they're beautiful. But how do you, I mean, if you think of an arch, and it's not structurally sound until it's complete, those vaults are the same way. If you don't get the whole thing built, it doesn't work. So building formwork under the entire thing would have been extremely laborious. So they realized that they could just build formwork for the ribs of those vaults. So right here we have the centering that is just making the rib. And you get a framework that actually, as a web, works pretty well structurally. It doesn't work real well, but it works pretty well structurally. It works good enough so that it can stand up on its own. And then you come back in, and for the infill between that, you use this process they call using ropes and stones, where they simulate the forces that the whole vault would have by putting a compressive force down on that stone and holding it in place until you put the next stone there, and then you lap that rope over it, and then you put the next stone and you lap that rope over it, and you're constantly simulating the loads that would be coming from the complete vault onto the existing vault like that. And by doing that over and over, you make the webs that go between those ribs of the groin vault at the top of both the nave and of the side aisles in Amiens. Again, clever inventions of ways to assemble the parts of the building. Now, we cannot imagine a Gothic cathedral without these innovations in building process. And this is the unsung thing that architects have to worry about all the time. This is a very big deal when you're designing a building. You've got to think, how will we build it? And how will it be efficient? Or how will it be cost effective? And if you don't do that, you don't freaking get the building built. So this becomes a very important element in designing a building, is thinking through that construction process and how it impacts the design of the building. And in the end, it would not be possible to have those soaring vaults, those beautiful open daylit spaces, if it were not for the innovations in building process that enabled the thing to be built. A second building, very interesting building. Again, there was this breakthrough building in building process that changed an entire era of architecture. That without these inventions in building process, we would not have had the Renaissance. So this is a very, very early Renaissance building, huge innovation. That really birthed an entire era of architectural expression in Italy. So this is Santa Maria della Fiore, the great cathedral in Florence, the building you see in Florence from a distance. It's the skyline of the city, is Santa Maria della Fiore. And it was begun in 1296, which is just 8 years after Amiens was finished. So we're talking about basically the same technology. Now, what was happening at that time is there had been the ascendance of Gothic architecture. That was what everybody did. And that had been birthed in France and in Germany, and as I said, to a lesser extent in England. But it was really France and Germany. They were the cultures in the medieval period that were economically thriving, that were making innovations in science, in arts, you know, everything was happening in France and in Germany. Italy was the pits, kind of sucked down in Italy. And one reason it kind of sucked down in Italy, and in particular in Tuscany, the area of Italy where Florence is, was because they'd been warring with each other. They had all these internecine battles. And in particular in Florence, there were two big families, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines.
And the Guelph family hated the Ghibellines, and the Ghibellines hated the Guelphs. And they were both kind of economically powerful families in Florence. And the entire city was kind of divided into these two camps. And they were constantly undermining each other and fighting with each other. And the truth is they didn't do things that were very productive because they had all this political turmoil. So all the way through the medieval period, most of Italy, but in particular Florence, was extremely disorganized. They were not pulling together as a society. And that meant they weren't doing very sophisticated education or science or arts or anything. So this church, Santa Maria della Fiore, was begun in this kind of lax period of Italian history. And they were just borrowing from the Germans and the French. So they were doing what was called Italian Gothic. It was a kind of lame, second-rate Gothic that was borrowed from the Germans and the French. And in fact, they didn't even know the technology for building this. So they had to import workers from France and from Germany to come down to Florence to help build the cathedral. So they're starting to build this Gothic cathedral in 1296, and they get a fair way along with it, these dark black walls. Those are the walls of the original Gothic cathedral, and it's got a nave down the center, and it's got side aisles, just like the Gothic cathedrals in France. It doesn't have flying buttresses. It's lame. It's just barely got a few. It's got the little pointed arches for affectation here and there. It's got the general organization. But this is not going to be a great Gothic cathedral. But you know, it's going to be a church, okay? And they're moving forward. Then in the very beginning of the 14th century, they have a huge catastrophe in Florence. They have what's called the Black Death. And like 40% of the population died of disease in this period. And it was catastrophic. All construction on the cathedral stopped. All business in the city stopped. But one other thing that kind of came out of it that was good was they stopped fighting with each other, and they start pulling together to try to recover from this horrible medical catastrophe. And so from, I don't know, maybe 1320 to 1350 or 60, pretty much nothing is done on this cathedral. Then when they come out of this in the middle of the 14th century, now they're actually beginning to get some sense of identity of their culture in Florence. They're saying, we're not warring with each other anymore. We've beat this horrible disease. And now we're ready to really do some great things in Florence. Their economy improved. They were merchants, and they began to have some successes in that regard. And so they began to have bigger ambitions for this new cathedral. And they looked at their plans for this lame, second-rate Gothic cathedral, and they said, bullshit, that's not going to work. It's not who we are. That's not the future of our culture. That's what we were before we proved to ourselves we could beat this thing. So they decided instead to rethink the design of the cathedral. And one of the things they did was they imagined a dome at the end of this piece they had built. So instead of having a Gothic termination like Amiens, which is normally a crossing and no big space at the end, what if we built a big, badass dome? So they could go down to Rome, and they could see the Pantheon. It's sitting there. And they realized, holy shit, our predecessors could build these amazing open spaces with these big domes on top, and they're badass, and they are gorgeous, and we could do that. That's our history. That's not this lame French and German bullshit. This is who we are. We could do this really cool dome at the end of our cathedral. And they knew it would stand up. The Pantheon had stood up for centuries, so that was going to work. but they had no idea how to build it. We still don't know how they built the Pantheon. We don't know how they built Hagia Sophia. It was lost. That's why they called medieval time the Dark Ages. A lot of technology and knowledge was lost in that period. But they had lost the building technology that the Romans had. They had lost it in Italy in the 13th, 14th century. So they imagined that dome, and they even built a little model of the finished cathedral. And they put it in the side aisle right here of the half-constructed building. And it was big enough that people could walk inside. You kind of walk inside and look up and see, whoa, damn, look at that dome. That'd be cool. And people kind of got, excited about it. But they didn't know how to build it. So they started building it, thinking we'll figure it out as we go. The original dome was supposed to be like that. That's what that model looked like in the cathedral. So this is the piece they had built already, and this was the piece they were imagining. So they thought, okay, well, the first thing we'll do is we'll build some of these semi-domes, because you could see them used like we saw in Hagia Sophia. Okay, that's one of the things we're going to need, some semi-domes around here. And we'll do some flying buttresses, only they were kind of lame buttresses, but we'll do some buttresses around there, some more semi-domes here, more buttresses. They're building it up from the ground. And honestly, it's not very logical. They're hoping that will take all these loads from the dome down into the ground, but they still don't know how to build the dome. So at a certain point, they had a big competition. And this is the latter part of the 14th century. And they asked all the architects, all the engineers around to submit their proposal for how you would build the dome. Now they've built the wing here at the beginning. They built all this claptrap of semi-domes and buttresses, all this stuff down here. But what they're trying to figure out is how do we build that? And so there were lots of entries. I have a favorite entry that did not win. This one was very cool. I absolutely think this should have won. It didn't win. This guy had the idea that the way you build that dome is that you take all this dirt from the countryside and you bring it around and you fill the entire cathedral with dirt and you build a mountain out of the dirt that is the shape of the dome, and then you just lay the stone up on top of the mountain of dirt and it becomes the formwork and it makes your dome. Pretty damn clever, don't you think? I mean, you can bring in as much dirt as you want with wheelbarrows, no big deal. It doesn't take big technology. Very, very clever. But people questioned, well, then how would you get the dirt out of the cathedral? And the guy said, oh, that's simple, totally simple. We embed coins in the dirt as we put it in there, and the Florentines are so greedy and so ambitious, they'll figure out a way to get that dirt out in order to get the coins. So he didn't win, but it was a good idea. The guy who won was a guy named Filippo Brunelleschi. That's him. And he is now considered one of the two fathers of the Renaissance. It's Alberti and Brunelleschi. Those are the two guys who invented the Renaissance. And part of why he's credited with that is because he figured out how to build this dome. And he really had, actually his father had been working on the cathedral. So he was there in Florence, and he had a background in construction. He had four big ideas for how you build this. So the first thing is he said, forget all this claptrap of buttresses and semi-domes. We're going to build a tambour or drum for this whole dome to set on. And that meant it was going to sit higher than was imagined before. And it was not going to just muddle into the rest of the building. It would be tall and strong and proud. So the first thing he wanted to do was just clear out all that stuff before and just build this tall drum that the dome would sit on. And the second thing is the sort of divide and conquer idea is we're going to build the ribs first. So he made 8 ribs that went around the dome. And those would have very strong reinforcing as they came down into the building. And those eight ribs would be the major structure. And instead of having to build the whole dome at once, we could just build a rib and another rib and another rib, and that would be smaller chunks. And then in between those eight major ribs, there would be two minor ribs between each one, making a total of 24 ribs. So you build the eight major, then you build 16 minor, and now you're slowly beginning to build up an armature or a frame that makes that dome. So that was the second big idea, was the ribs. The third big idea was to actually make the dome in two layers. So if you'd made the kind of the thickness of dome that was required for the spans, it would have been so heavy that it would have been very hard to construct all at once. So if you built it in two smaller layers and then you connected them together and to get eventually get that thickness, that would allow you to do it more piecemeal and in smaller chunks that you could actually achieve. So it was actually built as two layers of dome that were then kind of glued together by these connectors in between. And that's actually what that space between the domes looks like now. That also became the way that they brought the materials up and down for the erection of the building. So there are all kinds of steps and passageways through that that allowed you, and this was much safer than, say, in the Gothic Cathedral, where you could fall down and kill yourself. But now all that those construction workers were going in this kind of protected area between the two layers of the dome. So has anybody gone to the top of the dome of Santa Maria della Fiore? A few of you. Well, you go up through this space when you go to the top of that dome, and you see that what was a construction device in order to enable them to build that dome. So that's the third element he used. The fourth element is he used chains. So there are little channels that were cut in the stone. You can see how thick that stonework is. Little channels that were cut there that you would embed a chain made of cast iron, and then you would grout that chain in. And in a way, this was the beginning of reinforced masonry. He was using not steel. Steel is better than cast iron, but cast iron is good intention. And it's like putting a belt around this dome. So as those loads came down, they could be cinched in by that belt there that kept them together. And as a building process thing, that was easy to put in. There's a lot of strength without having to put quite so much stone in there. You could use the little bits of steel to save you large quantities of stone. And that meant they just didn't have to have all that weight and all that stone up there in the dome. So it was really those four things, the timber, the ribs, the ability from those ribs to build double layer of webbing between it, and then the chains, those four things, allowed them to actually construct the dome. Now, there were many other devices just for erection and for scaffolding and other things, and Brunelleschi designed them as well. He was a very clever guy. And in the end, they got this magnificent dome, and that really began the whole idea of the Renaissance. Renaissance churches, all or most of them, have these magnificent domes all the way to St. Peter's. You know, St. Peter's wouldn't be there if it weren't for Santa Maria della Fiore. They had to figure out how do you make a dome. When they figured it out, then they could make domes in churches all over Italy. And this was part of an essential part of the Renaissance and a complete transformation of what especially church architecture was. Okay, so those are, okay, in primitive societies, they're making these big advances. It's giving them huge capabilities that is shaping whole eras of architecture. Is there some application of this in our own time? And a great example in the 20th century is the Sydney Opera House. This was built between 1957 and 1973. Very interesting story here. Again, this was a design competition. There were hundreds of entries from all over the world. They assembled this distinguished jury in Sydney to decide which would be the competition winner. The chair of that jury was Eero Saarinen, who we've looked at buildings by him before. He was the chair of the jury. He's American. Turned out there were weather problems or something. His flight got delayed. Back in those days, there were like one or two flights from the United States to Australia a week. So when his flight got canceled, he had to wait for the next one, and it was several days. So the rest of the jurors were there. They assembled together, and they said, well, we're not going to wait for Arrow. We're just going to, we'll sort through all these, and we'll take the complete losers, and we'll kind of put them in the basement, and then we'll save 50 or so that we can look at with Arrow, and he can help us make the final decision. He was the big dog on the jury. He was the famous guy. So they do that. Arrow comes. He looks at the 50 or 60 they've saved, says, bullshit, these are crap. This is not good enough. This is an amazing opportunity, and they're not. You're not being ambitious enough. He goes down to the basement, starts sorting through the rejects. Is there anything in here that would be magnificent? And he comes across these drawings that were done by a young guy in Denmark. And the drawings did not follow the rules. They did not have all the requirements of the submission. They just had a few little sketchy ideas of this winged, amazing opera house. So Arrow Saarinen takes these drawings up to the rest of the jury and says, this is it, man. This is one not a win. All these others are very complete, and they're thorough, and they're well thought through, and this is just a kind of half-ass idea for what this thing might be. These sails that would be on the harbor of Sydney and would have this opera house inside. Well, he convinced them all. He was a silver-tongued bastard, and he convinced them all, and it became the winning entry. It was published in the newspaper, and everybody just was like, what? They'd never seen a building like this before. It was very half-baked. They bring this young Danish architect down to Australia. They interview him. He's handsome, tall, kind of charismatic, so he's got a good personality and that builds some confidence. And they decide to go with this thing. But they have no idea how to build it. Jorn Utzon had no idea how to build it. They hire the best engineers in the world, Ove Arup in London. They start making computer models and trying to figure out how you might do it with cast-in-place concrete. Of course, by now, you can do formwork out of steel, but you know, it would be hugely expensive. You have to build a whole steel building and then build a concrete building on top of it and then tear out the steel building. That seemed dumb. They were just at wit's end. They had to get this thing started. It was using public money. The politicians were getting antsy about getting under construction. So they start pouring the foundation and they start moving along. But they still don't know how they're going to build these shells. They thought about precasting them, but those shapes in his drawings, they're a different curvature at every point along them. So there's nothing standard or repetitive in them. And it would have been just insane, you know, thousands and thousands of individual parts, each unique precast to put the thing together. Then one morning, Jorn Utzon is having grapefruit for breakfast. And he starts cutting the peel of his grapefruit. And he realizes he can make forms that are very similar to the shapes of his sketch in a uniform curvature, so that they would all be part of the same spherical shape. That then allowed them to precast them so that all of those pieces would be interchangeable because they are all the same radius of a sphere. And that was a game changer. It was a different design, substantially. It was different proportions and shapes. You can see, look at that on the left and compare it to this on the right. And you can see the shape was really very different, but the idea was still there. And that was the breakthrough that allowed them then to precast the pieces and to erect them with cranes. Still wasn't easy, but they did that. And you can see it went from 1957 to 73, 16 years of construction. That is not a 20th century building. This is like medieval. It took so long to build this. There were many other innovations that Jorn Utzon had in the building and that required significant construction issues. You see that glass piece right there? He imagined that would be made all out of glass, no steel. So some of the glass was 2 feet thick in order to make that happen. And he got a manufacturer in France who was able to make 2 foot thick glass that would be structural. But it was incredibly expensive and difficult, and the price of everything was going way up. So finally, at that point, they fired Jon Utzon, and they finished the building with another architect. And so, although many of just the framework of the building, all of these details, those are Utzon. On the interiors, it was another architect. Even the tiles on the outside, very beautiful, those are all Utzon. But when you get inside, that was another architect, because they fired Utzon and sent him back to Denmark. And he actually didn't see the building completed until 30 years later, when he was asked to come back and do some renovations for the building. The building's original budget was $3 million. That was in 1957. The cost of the building was $108 million, more than 30 times the original budget. It was incredibly challenging in every way in terms of building process. But in the end, there is this magnificent building that people come from all over the world to see. You cannot get a seat for a performance in the Sydney Opera House because they're booked years in advance, not because the Sydney Symphony Orchestra is so badass amazing, but because the building is a jaw-dropping, unbelievable landmark in the entire world. Okay, Twitter card question for today. Was it worth it in the Sydney Opera House? Is it right for an architect to challenge the construction industry, building process, so to do something like the Sydney Opera House, and then in so doing, make something that is incredibly expensive because we're having to invent how to do it? Is this something we should be doing in the 21st century? Or is this bullshit, ridiculous? We've got plenty of good technology right now. Buildings should not be jumping out and making these huge demands on building process. Or is there ever a time to do this? Should it be once in a lifetime? Should it be once in a city? How often or should it never be done? What do you think about the kind of challenge that the Sydney Opera House presents to building process?